Water is essential to life, but also agriculture, industry, and energy. It is the foundation of modern civilization. But ever-rising consumption and climate change have many worried there won't be enough to go around. Meanwhile, sea level rise and extreme weather threaten some areas with disaster. How can we avoid conflict and build peace? How can we ensure that everyone has what they need to survive and thrive as we march toward a global population of more than 9 billion? You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. In this special series, Water Stories, we highlight experts and practitioners from around the world to hear how people are thinking about and addressing water, peace, and conflict challenges. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's interview, we'll hear from Dr. Erica Weinthal, the Lee Hill Snowden Professor of Environmental Policy in the Nicholas School at Duke University. Erica, your research has focused on environmental governance, conflict, and peacebuilding for more than 20 years since the early days of the field. Could you talk to us about how you got involved in the field and what you're focusing on today?
Thanks, Lauren. It's always fun to reflect on where one began and where one is today. And as you noted, I've been working on water, conflict, and cooperation for quite some time. My work has evolved over time, where I began working in what was then the Soviet Union and the successor states in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union in Central Asia, looking at water cooperation and conflict. At the time, I was really interested in what happens during periods of institutional flux. I was interested in looking at a system of water management where you had a domestic system that was transformed with the creation of new states. So you had an international system that required the new states in Central Asia to share the rivers that flowed into the Aral Sea. And at the time, there was a lot of concern globally about whether the states would be in conflict with one another over the different uses of the rivers, the Amudarya and the Sirdarya, or whether they would create new mechanisms for cooperation. And so that's where I began my career, spending considerable time both in the capital cities, but also in the villages, really trying to understand what water institutions look like on the ground in situations of institutional flux. And that has always been an area that I've been concerned about, this notion of water institutions, water governance, and cooperation and conflict. My earlier work really was focused on this notion of how do you build cooperation and peace. And over time, as much as we've seen a large number of states build institutions for water sharing, we're increasingly seeing more conflict in the world. And so my current research has pivoted towards looking at active conflict and protracted conflict, trying to understand what happens in war when water systems and infrastructure is targeted, when infrastructure becomes weaponized, becomes a source of conflict, and what does that mean for human security? So in some ways, where I once began looking at what happens between states and institutions that manage interstate relations, my current research has really shifted to trying to understand what conflict surrounding water and water infrastructure means for individuals and communities and human security rather than state security.
Your research found that the systemic use of legal restrictions, infrastructure destroyed by settlers and state authorities, and permit denials for infrastructure construction in the West Bank are a type of slow violence by the Israeli occupation. Can you talk about what is meant by slow violence and where else we might see this playing out?
Slow violence is a term that was coined by the scholar Rob Nixon. And slow violence captures often what we don't see immediately when you have government policies that restrict access to natural resources, that result in contamination of natural resources. So an example of slow violence could be the contamination in the Niger Delta from oil contamination, that we often don't look at the long-term impacts on the ecosystem and on human well-being. And so it takes a different perspective because it focuses on what we often consider to be hidden. It can also refer to displacement of people from large dams as another example of slow violence. So it's also this notion of making something invisible, that these are people that are not counted in our traditional stats, or the impacts are so long term that they are often below the radar screen. And my colleague Jeannie Sowers at University of New Hampshire and I have been really interested in both looking at what happens in violent conflict, sort of immediate impacts, but also using Rob Nixon's concept of slow violence to understand the long-term impacts of policies in protracted conflict. And you mentioned the West Bank. And there, we've been really interested in the restrictions that have been placed on Palestinian civilians as a result of the more than five decades of occupation, Israeli occupation of the West Bank, what that has meant for access to water, where you have denials, have the permit system has led to a refusal to build new water infrastructure, wastewater treatment systems, to be able to drill new wells, but also what we're seeing is the destruction of agriculture and livelihoods, often by the settler population that will come and destroy olive trees and other fruit trees within Palestinian land and within Palestinian communities. And that has long-term impacts on livelihoods and well-being. And so that is how we've been looking at slow violence. And I should say, this is all part of a larger project that is trying to create a database to track instances of where civilian infrastructure and environmental resources are being targeted in conflict. So a lot of our work has focused on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, looking at variation in Gaza versus the West Bank, but we've also been looking at attacks on infrastructure in Iraq, Yemen, Syria, Libya, as well.
So in your research, do you see the weaponization of water or other environmental infrastructure becoming a tactic used with increasing frequency?
So it varies the extent to which water, and the language that we've been using in the project itself has been the extent to which infrastructure is being targeted. And in this case, water, given the importance of water for human health and well-being, but also for the agricultural sector and, links to water treatment and sanitation and all of that, is that it varies in each conflict. So when you look at Iraq, you may hear discussions about control over dams or targeting dams and what that would mean if the dams erupted and flooding of the population. Saddam Hussein deliberately drained the marshlands in southern Iraq. That was an example of targeting, wetlands as a way to hurt civilians, harm civilians. But in some of the conflicts, what we're seeing in many of these conflicts, and if we just take 2011 as the starting point, not Israel-Palestine, which is a much more protracted conflict in the Middle East, the conflicts that erupted after the Arab Spring, we're also seeing a change in the nature of warfare, where you're seeing a large number of groups that are vying for control. What we're seeing in the countries in the Middle East is both state actors and non-state actors engaged in the conflict, and some of them are international, some of them are domestic. It's no longer a traditional war between, interstate actors. And we're seeing different infrastructure being targeted at different times by different actors. So take Yemen, for instance. in the early years of the conflict, we saw a lot of attacks on energy infrastructure because energy, primarily oil, is a source of revenue. It's a sort, you know, fuel is really important and it can cut off revenue for the state. Whereas starting in 2015, we started seeing more attacks on water infrastructure, on agriculture, on health. And this was a result in many ways tied to the Saudi-led coalition entering the conflict. So you see a different form of warfare taking place. In Syria, we've seen, you know, everything being attacked and by all actors, both state actors and non-state actors. And so it just varies by region and by conflict.
The humanitarian and development communities are simultaneously responding to crises and conflicts on multiple fronts and struggle to integrate across sectors and timelines. What does your research mean for how development and humanitarian actors program on the ground? What steps can international and local humanitarian actors take to adapt to this challenge?
My work often looks at the entire conflict cycle, trying to understand the way water can be used to increase strife, can be used as an entry point for building peace, and then can be harnessed for post-conflict peace-building endeavors, has meant that it straddles what are often the silos that exist between the humanitarian sector and the development sector. And so we often think about water in the humanitarian sector as providing basic services, just getting access to potable water, wherein development is more long-term. So it's this tension between short-term interventions and long-term interventions. And they often at times work cross-purposes because the longer-term interventions are about building infrastructure, where short-term interventions are about not building anything that will have staying power, because the idea is to take care of people with the understanding that many of them may be displaced, they may be refugees, and that the intention is that at some point they will go back to their homes where they had fled. Sometimes, you know, they are just displaced internally within a city where they've lived too, but it has never been the focus on, you know, finding something that is permanent, a type of solution. And so this is a really interesting question, which comes up in our work, because in a place like Gaza, where you have periods of violent conflict, followed by what one could say, you know, there is some quiet, how does the humanitarian community interact with the development community? And what we find is you have periods of vast destruction of infrastructure being hit very hard and decimated through air power and active targeting. And then you have this period of how do you engage in reconstruction? And the term reconstruction is something that is constantly used in Gaza, and with the understanding that there's going to be the next period of destruction. There's a different understanding in some ways of what humanitarian assistance and development means in a situation like that, because it's never moving from one stage to the next. And having worked also in the post-conflict phase for a long time, there's implications of using the term post-conflict. We say, you know, the global community has often said Afghanistan is post-conflict, Iraq is post-conflict. But the empirical reality on the ground is that there is a lot of conflict still going on. And it's a conflict-affected region, country. This is a fragile state. And so the terminology that we use in some ways mandates a certain type of intervention. When you're in a post-conflict phase, it means we really should be moving away from humanitarian assistance into development. because we've moved along the conflict spectrum toward peace and development. But if you don't recognize that there's still conflict going on and that development needs to really take into account that much of what is vital for restoring livelihoods, improving the welfare of civilians, is thinking about providing basic access to water, and that there still is, in some cases, a protracted humanitarian crisis festering. And this is where I think from the policy side, why you need to have these broad, groups of actors at the table who can really have those conversations and think about coordination among, you know, what an NGO who's working in the humanitarian sector may be doing with one who's working in development. And if you're working in the water sector, does that mean providing potable water that's in bottles or through tankers? Or does it mean rebuilding pipes, drilling wells? Does it mean, you know, redesigning governance institutions for water management? Or does it mean engaging with the local informal sector? And so I think these are some of the pressing issues that are facing many of the countries globally today that are somewhere in between, where it's not quite post-conflict and it's not quite active conflict.
I wonder, could you back up just for a minute for our audience that might be coming at this from the perspective of a water specialist, mm-hmm. and walk through the conflict cycle? Just conflict 101.
So there's the conflict cycle. For those of us who study conflict, you know, on the one hand, you have conflict and you have the absence of conflict, which would be peace. But it's a much more complex understanding of conflict when you look at it from the perspective of what are some of the underlying drivers of the conflict. So for those of us who work in natural resources, how may water or other natural resources result in conflicts where you may have scarcity over water and how that may generate conflict, to how you can then move from conflict to mediation, negotiations, to peace building, to the absence of conflict, which is peace. But often we don't want it just to be the absence of conflict. We really want it to move into development and generating in some ways what are the peace dividends of not being in war. So having productive livelihoods, improving the economic welfare of civilians, and alleviating poverty.
What does the future hold for water systems in the Middle East, where there were highly engineered water systems and complex urban environments?
What is striking about the conflicts throughout the Middle East and differs from conflicts elsewhere that we may have seen in sub-Saharan Africa are these conflicts are in urban centers. And it was an urban environment where you had very sophisticated water systems that, you know, provided water via tap sanitation systems. It may not have been clean water all the time or 24/7, but these are not rural systems. And so you have coupled systems that were highly, where water is linked to energy. And we've seen those completely decimated. And so one of the questions that one could ask, do you go back in and rebuild where you have a coupled water energy system where water and sanitation are linked and you take out energy? And if you take out energy infrastructure, you have all these reverberating effects where you can no longer treat water. You have sewage flowing into the streets. You can't, you know, it has implications for health facilities. Or do you build more mobile decentralized systems? Is that, you know, one could ask, is that the future, that we need to have a more decentralized system that could potentially be more resilient or in conflicts because these systems were also very centralized. And once you take out a centralized system, the whole system collapses. Whereas if there were decentralized systems, you may not lose the entire, you know, all your water services in a city. But there's also the question of, you know, in countries like Libya, you had the great man-made river to transport water from the desert to urban settings. And how do you maintain systems like that, that these large infrastructure projects, if you lose human capital and you lose water engineers? And so I think there's a lot of questions that we need to answer in thinking about both the maintenance and the rebuilding and what a future should look like for water services and water infrastructure throughout the Middle East.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.